Today is Thursday, October 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, as Turkish forces push further into northeastern Syria, Islamic State supporters in a detention camp in the area say they hope to escape and help support a revival of the IS militants. Also ahead...
We have a deal. And this deal means that there is no need for any kind of prolongation.
Britain and the EU appear to hammer out differences on Brexit as a two-day summit begins. Plus, protests continue to rock Catalonia in Spain. Those stories and more next. Fighting continues Thursday in northeastern Syria as Turkish forces push further into territory held by Kurdish-led forces, even as U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Syrian Defense Force, led by the Kurds, have been allies with the United States since 2014 in the fight against the Islamic State militants. Mr. Trump this week ordered U.S. forces to leave the area ahead of Turkey's advance into Syria to create what it calls a buffer zone along the border. The Turkish government considers the SDF a terrorist group allied with Kurdish separatists in Turkey. There is international condemnation of Turkey's incursion, with growing concerns of a humanitarian crisis as well as fears that it will result in suspected IS supporters escaping from detention camps where they are held. VOA's Heather Murdoch is in northeastern Syria and is the first Western journalist to enter the Al-Hol camp this week. More than 70,000 women and children live in the camp. The families of IS fighters who had fled the last territory held by the militants last year. Murdoch has visited the camp before, but this time she says it was so dangerous that she and her crew needed to be escorted by security forces.
Well, today we were the first journalists that have entered the Al-Hol camp in Syria since Turkey began its military operations last week. I've been there twice before, and what we saw today was pretty astounding and pretty shocking. What the camp officials told us was they have reduced the amount of security they have considerably by about two-thirds because a lot of the soldiers have gone to fight at the front, and that there's almost a revolution inside the camp. What she said exactly was, right now, all we are trying to do is make sure these people stay inside the camp, which is essentially a prison, because we cannot control anything inside. We walked around a little. We heard women cursing us. We saw women with weapons, like a hammer and a car angle. And that woman was yelling at the photographer, saying, you know, get out of here. We heard other hostile things, and the guards themselves have been attacked. The facilities have been attacked by hundreds of people, and they have been intermittently flying Islamic State flags. This all started after the still supposed ISIS leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, called for sleeper cells in the region to help all those families of ISIS escape. But since Turkey began military operations, apparently the people inside, there are about 71,000 women and children, mostly related to Islamic State fighters, have been emboldened and calling and saying that this is the time, that they want to escape the camp, and some have even said they want to join the Turks to fight the Kurds.
When you were there earlier this year, what was your reception like? How is this different?
Well, it was very different, but it wasn't that people weren't openly supporting Islamic State militants. When I first went there, I think in late February, when it was a camp already, but it was suddenly all of the people that were with the Islamic State retreating over the course of 2 years of war, and finally, in their last stronghold, fled the war. So those were the most hardcore extremist families came to this camp, including a lot of foreign families. And now, at first, when I would go in, people would say openly, I support the caliphate, I believe ISIS will rise again, it will happen, we pray that our fighters, you know, can hang on and come back. Even we would ask them things like, do you believe that we should die? You know, me as a Western journalist and my fixers, the Kurdish fixers, and they would say yes, but then it was calm, and they'd offer us a cup of tea as well. But this time, the people we encountered were openly hostile, and it felt very tense, dangerous.
Well, outside the camp, what are you seeing and hearing when you talk to people who are not part of the residents of the camp?
Well, one person we talked to today said that I had a colleague who was asking the question, what are you more afraid of, the people, the Islamic State people breaking out of the camp and the sleeper cells more or less awakening, or the Turkish military operations reaching the town of Hasaka, which is sort of in between the Turkish operations and this camp? And one person said both equally. Another person said they were more afraid of the Islamic State militants because, I don't have to guess, it seems more inevitable there because it's such a hot situation that it feels at the moment, if nothing changes, this is bound to spill out into the wider world. And in fact, people said this when I first started this camp, was basically a prison full of ISIS extremists, and that eventually it was going to turn into a disaster. Just no one expected it to happen quite this quickly.
And that was VOA's Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch speaking with International Edition's managing editor Kate Pound Dawson. Murdoch also said that because the camp has become so dangerous, most international aid groups have withdrawn from the area. There are fears the detainees soon will face shortages of water, food, which Murdoch says will only escalate tensions.
Mr. President.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, thank you for seeing me.
Good.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence have concluded their meeting with Turkish leaders seeking to seek out a ceasefire to the conflict in Syria. The meeting lasted over 4 hours, according to the vice president's office, double of the time that was originally allotted. The vice president and secretary are supposed to be having a press conference later outlining what was discussed. The 9-day offensive has left many civilians dead on both sides. The Kurdish Health Authority said 218 civilians, including 18 children and 5 medical personnel, have been killed. At least 20 Turkish civilians and 6 soldiers have also been killed. The Observatory for Syrian Rights said at least 203 fighters from the Kurdish-led forces and 171 from Turkish-backed Syrian factions have also been killed. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb joins us now with more. So, Carla, what can you tell us about U.S. forces in Syria? Because they have been withdrawn, but there was some equipment there, and they've run into some fire since they've been ordered to withdraw a week ago.
Well, they are still going through the withdrawal process. There are still U.S. troops in that northern area of Syria that are withdrawing as we speak. We heard the first of the base withdrawal beyond that 30-kilometer range that Turkey is targeting. We heard the first of that on Tuesday, and the Operation Inherent Resolve spokesperson said that the U.S. had pulled out of Manbij. That had happened relatively quickly, but I've been assured that no key equipment and no key data was left during that process. Then we heard that the Turkish forces were approaching Kobani, and as I've been told by a U.S. official, they came within 6 kilometers of U.S. forces. So what the U.S. did is they had a show of force. They released some F-15 fighter jets, told the Turks, we're nearby, be careful, don't approach. It appeared to work. At the same time, the Kurdish forces destroyed part of their operation center in Kobani that they shared with the United States. They moved out, then the U.S. moved out their equipment and their people as well. And then we saw yesterday the United States conducted airstrikes on its own base, so to speak, to destroy all of the equipment that was left there and to make it so no outside force could get any sort of insight on how the United States works.
So right now, Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are in Turkey trying to arrange a ceasefire with President Erdogan. Are there any discussions that you're aware of within the Pentagon for U.S. forces to go back and get anything from that area or to provide any kind of assistance in the interim period during that ceasefire?
It's unclear at this time. The latest orders that the Pentagon has received was to pull out from northern Syria virtually all, but give or take a couple hundred United States troops are going to remain in the south in Antanef base to help prevent ISIS there and to help stop Iranian influence in that area. But the rest have been told to move out, and that is what they are doing at this point. So until something happens, a senior U.S. defense official has said most of them will likely go to Iraq. That will be more, you know, solidified in the coming days. They may not stay in Iraq, but that's where they're moving at this point. And that's so they can monitor the Islamic State situation, because don't forget, the Islamic State fight is not completely over. There is a territorial defeat of the Islamic State, but the ideology is still very much there. There are still prisons there. There are still detention camps that need to be taken care of.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Britain and the European Union finally reached a tentative Brexit deal on Thursday, hoping to escape the acrimony, divisions, and bitter frustrations of their three-year divorce battle. Jean-Claude Juncker, the chair of the European Commission, made the announcement earlier today.
We have a deal. And this deal means that there was no need for any kind of prolongation. This is a fair, a balanced agreement. It is testament to our commitment to finding solutions. It provides certainty where Brexit creates uncertainty. It protects the rights of our citizens, and it protects peace and stability on the island of Ireland.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson tweeted that the two sides had struck a great new deal and urged UK lawmakers to ratify it in a special session being held on Saturday, the first time since 1982 that British lawmakers have planned to work on a Saturday.
And I hope very much now, speaking of elected representatives, that my fellow MPs in Westminster do now come together to get Brexit done, to get this excellent deal over the line and to deliver Brexit without any more delay, so that we can focus on the priorities of the British people, improving our health service, investing in 20,000 more police, lifting up the living wage, and many, many other things.
Now joining us on the phone from Brussels is reporter Henry Ridgewell. Henry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So what can you tell us about this deal that seemingly came out of nowhere after discussions yesterday were all over the place?
That's right. This was a surprise for many in Brussels and in London, and I think it's testament to the round-the-clock work that negotiators from both sides have put into it. And essentially, the sticking point was always the Irish border, as it has been since the referendum in 2016. They've got around it with a bit of smoke and mirrors, if you like. The main aim was to prevent a hard border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And they've done that by saying that effectively there will be customs checks between mainland Britain and the island of Ireland. And that will, in effect, mean that there will be no checks on the border in Northern Ireland. But the problem is the DUP party, the Democratic Unionists, who prop up Boris Johnson's government, aren't happy with it. And we can talk about what problems that will cause for the deal.
Yeah, I mean, because that just shifts where the customs check will be, right?
That's right. Effectively, there will be a legal customs border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland de jure, so by law. But de facto, in reality, the border will be down the Irish Sea, and any goods crossing that border that will be at risk of then entering the EU will have to be separately checked on that customs border down the Irish Sea. Now, it's a clever way to get around any hard border in Northern Ireland, but the problem is that the DUP, as I mentioned, say that that creates a border within the United Kingdom that effectively drives a wedge between England, Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. And that's something they've long campaigned against. They fear that that would set Northern Ireland on the path to reunification with the Republic of Ireland.
So moving forward, Henry, we have about 30 seconds left here. You know, this still has to be ratified by the EU during the summit and by Parliament in Britain on Saturday. What challenges remain for both those groups?
Right. This is being billed as a Super Saturday. And despite the optimism here in Brussels with Britain and the EU having struck a deal, that's going to be a big challenge. As I've mentioned, the DUP will not back it. And they've got 10 MPs who are propping up the government. And the other major opposition parties have also said they won't back it. It's also very likely that some of them may try to table amendments for a second referendum. So while the hard work in Brussels may be done, there's a lot of hard work for Boris Johnson still to do in London to persuade MPs to back this deal.
Henry Ridgewell is in Brussels watching the EU summit and the Brexit discussions. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Volcanoes can go from periods of inactivity to becoming restless before they actually erupt. A new study led by researchers at the Carnegie Institution of Science and the Pennsylvania State University suggests some volcanoes on the cusp of eruption can be persistently restless for decades. The researchers found that volcanoes could go through three states of unrest. Signs of their first state of unrest can include a steady release of gas and changes in seismic activity. The second state may include a series of weak explosions. However, signs of the third state of unrest could include the deformation of surrounding landscape and large explosions that include the expulsion of rock fragments. The researchers say their findings could lead to forecasting models for persistently restless volcanoes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. After the State Department blocked him from appearing last week, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland appeared today before the House lawmakers conducting an impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump's relations with Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland said Thursday that President Trump directed him and other envoys to work with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on Ukraine policy that he disagreed with that directive. According to a U.S. intelligence whistleblower, Sondland and other diplomats exchanged also a series of text messages in which the diplomats wondered why roughly $400 million in aid to Ukraine was frozen. Reports say that there was a five-hour-long gap between text messages during which Sondland telephoned Mr. Trump. One text assured another diplomat that there was no quid pro quo of any kind with Ukraine, followed by Sondland writing, "I suggest we stop the back and forth by text." On Wednesday, a former top aide to U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told House lawmakers that he quit last week in growing frustration over the politicization of the State Department, with the final straw being President Donald Trump's ouster of the well-regarded American ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Yovanovitch testified last week that Trump dismissed her based on unfounded and false claims after Trump's personal attorney, Mr. Giuliani, assailed her performance in Kiev. Trump continued Wednesday to attack the impeachment hearings against him. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff defended the process in a letter also on Wednesday. Now, today's hearings also come as it was announced that U.S. Congressman Elijah Cummings passed away. The AP's Mike Hempen has those details.
Cummings' congressional office says the congressman died early this morning at Johns Hopkins Hospital due to complications from longstanding health issues. As chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, Cummings led several investigations into President Trump's governmental dealings. He played a key role in the congressional inquiry into the president's attempts to pressure Ukraine's president into investigating Joe Biden. Cummings was 68 years old. I'm Mike Hempen.
Chaos reigned for a second consecutive day in the halls of Hong Kong's legislature Thursday as pro-democracy lawmakers once again heckled Chief Executive Carrie Lam. Lam was forced to cut short her annual policy speech on Wednesday. Lam was again shouted down when she returned to the chamber Thursday for a question and answer session about her policy speech, with opposition lawmakers demanding her resignation. Several of them were also forcibly dragged out of the chamber by security guards. A U.S. fleet has begun the sea phase of a joint maritime training near the contested waters of the Spratly Islands with naval assets of the Philippines and Japan. U.S. Coast Guard cutter Stratton sailed out of the harbor of Puerto Princesa, Palawan on Thursday along with four U.S. Navy vessels. In answering a question of VOA in Puerto Princesa on Monday, U.S. Navy Captain Antoinette McCann said that the U.S. Coast Guard has an important role in working with U.S. Navy for the security and prosperity of the region. A 93-year-old former concentration camp guard arrived in court in a wheelchair Thursday in what could be one of Germany's last trials of Nazi war crimes. Prosecutors say he was part of a force manning the watchtowers in Stutthof concentration camp near the city of Gdansk in Poland, according to prosecutors. Because he was 17 or 18 at the time of the alleged offenses, the individual will be tried in a youth court. In Barcelona, Catalan separatists pushed ahead with protests against the sentencing of nine of their leaders. They are blocking roads and railways in northeastern Spanish region, and there are plans for a general strike on Friday. In addition, Catalonia's separatist leader vowed to hold a new vote to secede from Spain in less than 2 years as the embattled northeastern region grapples with a wave of violence that has tarnished a movement proud of its peaceful activism. For more details, I spoke with journalist Martin Arostegui. Martin, if you could, can you describe these protests these last few days for us?
They were expected. It's been particularly sharp in the last few days. They have been much more violent than usual. There's been a level of violence which has until now not been experienced in the Catalan conflict, or at least not at the level and consistency that it has in the past 48 to 72 hours. If not in time, they certainly haven't entirely paralyzed Barcelona, but they've certainly caused a very large amount of disruption and a lot of public distress.
In terms of public distress, what percentage of those in the Catalan region are supporting the protests and those that are calling for more calm? Because I understand there's also a call for a general strike tomorrow on Friday.
These general strikes usually aren't very supported. I mean, they usually are mainly based among the student population and a very, very small part of the actual working population. They usually don't get much response. Frankly, the independence movement in Catalonia has limited public support. It has about, according to our most recent polls, it has maybe about 40%, maybe a little bit more than that, 40, 42%, who favor outright independence. But there is almost an equal amount of people who are opposed to independence and, you know, a small amount dissatisfied. So it definitely has an appeal among a large sector of the Barcelona public opinion, it by no means represents even a majority of Catalan.
So what's going to happen now that there's a call for another referendum within 2 years? Isn't this going back to where things were 2 years ago?
The government of Spain is not going to allow it. They've said that there's going to be no referendum, and I mean, they can have another public consultation, I suppose. Maybe Sanchez might go for that. A more conservative government wouldn't even allow that. But it would not be binding. And the central government is not going to recognize the referendum or any result that comes of it. It goes against Spain's constitution for any region to decide to break away on its own, and I don't see a Spanish government likely to retreat from that position anytime soon.
How long do you see these protests going on, given that the convictions just came down and the dissatisfaction with the sentences that were handed out?
It's a case in which the government may well end up with the worst of both worlds. I mean, the sentences, while they seem draconian, they're actually quite lenient. But of course, yeah, it doesn't seem to be in any way appeasing the independence movement, who are definitely on the streets and demanding that they be released altogether, that they consider them as a matter of principle, and that they should be absolved altogether, and that's the only kind of sentence they will accept.
Martin Arostegui is in Madrid. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Calvin Fowler, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news on our VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.